This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Our first guest this morning is Paul Shapiro. He's an inductee into the Animal Rights Hall of Fame. He also serves as a vice president of policy engagement for the Humane Society of the U.S. Paul Shapiro joins us to discuss his new book called Clean Meat, How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World. He says we're witnessing the very beginning of an incredible revolution, a clean meat revolution. What is clean meat? Well, it is an incredible concept that we're about to find out. Paul Shapiro, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, John. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I have to tell you, Paul, that I have never heard John more excited and blown away by any interview that we have done so far in the last 5 years. So this is really incredible. And I have to say that while I know that bioengineering is bringing us a lot of innovative new ideas, I had not really heard of using cells taken from a little muscle biopsy of an animal to produce and grow real meat, clean meat. Start there.
Well, first, I'm very honored, so thank you, and thanks, John. But, yeah, so clean meat is not an alternative to meat. It is not a substitute for meat. It is real, actual meat that is grown from animal cells. So the way that you described it, Lynn, is right. You take a tiny sesame seed-sized biopsy of muscle, let's say from a chicken or a pig or a cow, and you can put that little biopsy, which has millions of cells in it, into a cultivator, and those cells believe that they are still inside of the animal's body. And then they do exactly what they would do were they still in the body, which is multiply and create new muscle cells, meaning meat. After all, that's what meat is. It is muscle. And when you add in some fat, and you really end up getting meat that is the same as the meat that we eat today, except much safer and much more ecologically sustainable because it takes so many fewer resources to grow. And of course, better for animals because we don't have to raise them on factory farms and then slaughter them.
Yeah. So talk about the lack of sustainability within our animal raising practices today. I mean, we hear of some of them, but you bring forth some pretty staggering statistics.
Sure, Lynn. So the United Nations claims that about 15% of all greenhouse gas emissions on Earth come from animal agriculture, raising animals for food. That's more greenhouse gas emissions than from the entire transportation sector combined, more than all the cars and planes and boats and trucks all combined. However, when growing clean meat, one life cycle analysis from Oxford University shows that to produce clean beef compared to conventional beef, you're talking about a 96% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and a 99% reduction in land use and similar reductions in water use and more. And when you think about just how many problems the factory farming of animals causes, not just climate change, which is, of course, an existential crisis, but land pollution, water pollution, air pollution, and the extreme inefficiencies entailed in producing animal products, if we can get a lot more efficient and a lot more ecologically sustainable about how we produce meat, maybe we'll be able to feed ourselves into the coming decades as humanity's population continues to climb and more people, especially in the developing world, want to eat more meat. Maybe we'll be able to satiate that demand with clean meat rather than having to tear down more forests in order to provide either cropland or pasture land for more farm animals.
It's just fascinating. We have rising sea waters that'll be coming along over the next several years. By 2050, we have a billion additional people that may be on the planet by 2050. With the rising sea waters, we may have not only people on the move, but we may have less farmland. So all of these things are really important. And when you talk about water, talk about, if you would, some of the products that we take for granted. We go to the grocery store and we buy maybe milk, maybe an egg, maybe a chicken, and how much water they actually consume from from the time that they're in an egg to the time they're a chicken, for an example?
Sure. Great question, John. So imagine that you walk into the supermarket and you see this poultry aisle in front of you. Now imagine that in order to purchase just one whole chicken, you have to also go get a 1 gallon plastic jug of water, unscrew the cap, and then dump out that gallon jug of water onto the supermarket floor. Now imagine doing that 1,000 more times. That's about how much water it takes to bring one chicken from shell to shelf. Comparing that to if you were able to, for example, grow that chicken meat without having to raise the whole chicken, you would use far less water in order to do that. In fact, it was Winston Churchill in 1931, before he became Prime Minister of Great Britain, who predicted that we would have queen meat. He didn't use that term, but he wrote in an essay in 1931 that one day we will escape what he called the absurdity of raising an entire chicken just to get the wing or the breast when we could grow those foods in a suitable medium without having to raise the whole animal. And so if you're concerned about water use or land use or climate change or animal welfare, growing meat without animals is a wonderful solution to help advance our species.
Yes. And talking about animals in the United States, there are 35 million cattle that are slaughtered every year, but it's really the birds. There's 9 billion chicken and turkeys. That would mean that would equate, when you do the math, to 300 killed every second. So that would really change the way we do business. I have to believe. I mean, back in the days of the horse and buggy, when they were replaced by the automobile, whole industries had to adopt or they had to completely change: the stables, the blacksmiths, the farmers that were bringing horses onto the market, the grain companies and all of those, but they were not organized to lobby change. I can only imagine the lobbying effort by the pesticide companies, the genetic modified corn growers, the industrial slaughterhouses, big pharma, and there's something that you mentioned in the book, what really surprised me, that 80% of antibiotics that are prescribed or just consumed in this country, 80% are for animals and not to make an animal more healthy, but to make an animal gain weight quicker or produce larger and quicker eggs, you know, those sorts of things. So this would really be quite a change for the country, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. And John, you raised the very good point about horse buggies, because the only way we had for thousands of years to transport ourselves around, if we weren't walking around ourselves, was essentially by horse. And then all of a sudden, you have the advent of the Model T, and an entire industry is essentially displaced by a superior new technology. Similarly, we used to only have ice that came out of lakes, and there was a huge ice shipping industry all around the world where ice was harvested from lakes and transported to hotter climates so people could have ice for their in-home ice boxes. Now we have a technological innovation called refrigeration that allows us to make our own ice via technology rather than getting it from nature. And none of us consider freezers unnatural. We all have them in our homes and probably wouldn't consider living without them. But to your point, John, at the time, there was actually a strong lobby from the ice shipping industry. In the mid to late 1800s, there was this great lobby campaign by the natural ice industry to deride what they called artificial ice, saying that this new human-made ice could be dangerous, it could sicken you, and it wasn't as good as the so-called real thing from nature. Well, few of us would even consider eating ice out of a lake today with good reason. And the same is so with clean meat. In the same way that for millennia, the only way we had to get ice was out of a lake, for millennia, the only way we've had to get meat is essentially out of animals' bodies. Now, a new technology is allowing us to make meat on our own that is the same thing, just as ice from your freezer. It's just ice. It's just ice. This is just meat, except it's much, much safer because it's grown in a far more hygienic environment, which is one reason that it's called clean meat, because you have to worry so much less about food safety concerns like intestinal pathogens. So think about it, like E. coli, Salmonella, Campylobacter. These are all intestinal pathogens that can sicken us if we don't cook the crap out of our meat, literally. And we're literally cooking the crap out of the meat, whereas with clean meat, you don't have to worry so much because they're not growing intestines at all. They are just growing the muscle that is the meat that we want to eat. And so, yes, there will be some displacement in the economy, just in the way that cars displaced horse-drawn carriages, or refrigeration displaced the natural ice industry, or, frankly, the way that Netflix displaced Blockbuster, or digital photography displaced Kodak. But that's the economy. Right. New inventions occur, and we have better products that suit our needs better for us.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Paul Shapiro. His book is Clean Meat: How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World. So, Paul, for our listeners, it's funny, as you're talking, I'm having this visual that I imagine some of our listeners may be having as well. And it's sort of a cartoon, and it's like these little cells and a test tube, and then suddenly out of it comes this filet mignon. And I know it's not like that. I know that the first cultured hamburger was produced and eaten in 2013. So it's relatively new, but actually 2013, that's a while ago. Explain the process to us how do we get this filet mignon, for example?
Sure, Lynn. So sadly, there's no filet mignon yet. So what these companies are working with, and there are about two dozen startups that have been formed in the last 3 years for the purpose of commercializing this type of clean meat. None of it has been commercialized yet, but it is expected that it will be in the coming years, not decades. And so what these companies are doing, by and large, is taking a little biopsy from meat, whether from a living animal in some cases or sometimes a slaughtered animal. And they can put them into, like I said, a cultivator, and the cells think that they're in the body still. And you feed those cells the way that they would be fed inside of an animal's body, with amino acids and fats and sugars, exactly what they would be eating were they still inside of the animal's body. And those cells start dividing just as they do in the body to produce more meat. So these cells are often what they're called is like satellite cells. And these are cells that are in all of our muscle. They're in your muscle and in my muscle. And they're just waiting to build more muscle. So if you do a hard workout or you get bruised, what these cells do is they go to work and they start repairing the broken tissue and creating new muscle. And so the only career for these cells is to become more muscle. That's it. That's the only thing they can do. And that is the key way of growing these types of ground meats, for whether it be for chicken nuggets or meatballs or hamburgers or hot dogs or sausages or fish sticks or crab cakes and so on. You see the way that these cells are able to basically be encouraged to do exactly what they would do anyway.
So GMOs, genetically modified organisms, we shop at stores that have a commitment to have no GMO products. It's what you're talking about sounds pretty genetically modified, sounds pretty fake. What do you say about that? I mean, you have been talking about the health benefits and the sustainability and all of these wonderful components that clean meat could bring. But what do you say about that other side, the more nefarious dark side?
Sure. Well, none of this involves genetic modification. You could use GM technology on this, but none of the companies are doing that for pretty much the reason that you're citing, Lynn, which is that there is some consumer dis-ease with using genetic modification. But these are techniques that are already widely used in medicine, in the field of tissue engineering, not genetic modification, but tissue engineering. And a lot of the foods that we eat today are also the product of pretty serious genetic changes that we have instilled in them. And I don't mean just selective breeding for, let's say, animals or plants that render them a far cry from the original species, which were domesticated. But even if you think about cheese, you know, right now, nearly all of the hard cheese in our country has rennet in it that is the product of genetic engineering. So it used to be that if you want cheese to curdle, you need rennet, and that used to come from calf's intestinal linings. Well, a few decades ago, we discovered how through genetic engineering, we could create the relevant enzyme in rennet, which is called chymosin, and through genetic engineering, created it, and now we don't need calf intestinal linings for cheese anymore. But virtually all cheese, all the hard cheese that people are eating in America today has that rennet in it that is the product of genetic engineering. And people aren't that concerned about it. They maybe don't even know about it, but that's how it's made. When you start thinking about the way that current meat is produced, and you compare that to how clean meat is produced, I think it becomes pretty clear just how preferable clean meat is. So I'll give you an example. Right now, most of the chickens who we eat in this country are genetically selected to grow so big, so fast, that many of them have difficulty taking more than a few steps before they collapse. They live overcrowded in their own feces. They're given drugs, like you mentioned earlier, John, and they never see the sun. They never step foot on a blade of grass. And when it's time for slaughter, well, most people probably don't want to know about it. And so when you consider just how unnatural and unsustainable our current methods of meat production are, growing meat from animal cells seems to be a preferable option.
Yeah, and in your book, you talk about the factory system. There's a lot more information on the living conditions for these chickens if they're producing eggs or if they're getting fat for meat and other animals as well. You also talk about the technology and what the possibilities are for the future and what some of the several major barriers that will be facing the entrepreneurs that are looking at this type of business. And you also talk about what the meat would be like. So for an example, when you take a biopsy of the size of a sesame seed and it has all these satellite cells and you start giving it the nutrients to be able to replicate itself, it's not replicating the gristle or the collagens that bind these muscle cells together. And that's why I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's why you would have more of a ground meat sort of hamburger type product than you would a finished steak, because there's all these other pieces that are not being replicated. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, John, that most of what's been done so far has been growing muscle. But meat is a lot more than muscle. Even ground meat is more than muscle. It's fat, it's connective tissue. And so there are some companies, like, for example, one of the new entrants into the clean meat startup space is a company called Mission Barns that is producing clean fat. They are creating real animal fats that are not produced from animals at all. Another company, though, one in Israel called Aleph Farms, another new company, is now producing clean connective tissues. So they're making real connective tissue that doesn't involve the raising and slaughtering of animals. So as this very nascent industry matures, you can see that there's actually room for a lot of different players in here, not just to grow the muscle, but to grow the fat, to grow connective tissues. One company is even now engineering the type of heme that is found in animal blood so that you can have that same taste that that meat has from that. So it appears like we're going to have a future in which people will really be having their meat and eating it too, where we can still enjoy the taste that we love without having to cause so many problems getting it. It's almost like if you imagine the difference between how for many, many decades, the photography meant gelatin film, printing it out, waiting for it, and so on. And now all of a sudden, we have something that is dramatically better. We have digital photography where you get your photo back instantaneously after you take it. I mean, I remember when 1 hour photo came out, I was so excited that I could get my photos in 1 hour. Now, if it took 1 minute, people would be outraged and rioting. And so think about how that portends changes in other areas of our society, maybe like meat production. So in the past, it would have taken months or years to raise an animal before you slaughter the animal. And with clean meat, maybe you don't even need the animal. You just need, let's say, cells. So in the same way you might have an ice cream maker or a bread maker at home, maybe you have a meat maker and you order your cells in a tea bag and you put them in, and lo and behold, out comes your burger or your hot dog or whatever. That's not possible today, but it doesn't seem out of the realm of possibility for tomorrow.
And you also point out in your book that the editing tools for digital photography, you could have an application that would cost several million dollars, which now resides for free on your smart device.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's just amazing. Let's just take a minute and talk about taking all of this from the science lab, which is producing a burger or a chicken or a turkey nugget, and being able to scale this. What are some of the significant barriers facing the entrepreneurs that you describe in this book?
Well, there are a few. So the first is just getting costs down. Right now, this type of meat is prohibitively expensive. Lynn mentioned that the first burger that was debuted in 2013, that ended up costing about $250,000 to produce. Now, that has come dramatically down. So now the price is hovering a little bit above $1,000 a pound. So there has been a type of Moore's law, so to speak, of reduction in cost for these cellular agriculture products. Now, it needs to come down a lot more, though. Nobody's buying $1,000 burgers. And for the most part, you're not going to see any realistic wide-scale commercialization of clean animal products in the next year or two. Maybe something symbolic, like a sale here or there, but nothing like grocery store shelves. So the one is cost, and the biggest way to reduce cost is to reduce what the cells are fed, because right now a huge cost is just in feeding them. Now, another potential barrier, though, to answer your question even more directly, John, is government regulation. So out of concern for these types of products, the state of Missouri this year passed a law that says that you cannot call it meat if it did not come from what they call traditionally harvested, meaning slaughtered animal. So these products are meat. Again, they're meat in the same way that ice made from your freezer is still ice, even though it didn't come from nature. And so they need to be called meat. They're not an alternative. They're not a substitute. These are actual meat from animals. And so with states like Missouri engaging in protectionist legislation to try to protect their cattle industry, that's going to be a real barrier for this industry going forward. Now, fortunately, groups like the ACLU and the Good Food Institute are already suing Missouri to overturn that law, saying that they had no place to do it. But that's another real barrier. And then third, there's still the question of whether consumers will want to eat this. Mm-hmm. Surveys do show that lots of consumers are willing to eat clean meat. But I presume that there will be some who won't. But even the most pessimistic surveys, the ones that show the worst results when they use a really disgusting term to describe it, for example, they still show that about 20% of people say they'd be happy to eat it. And that's 20%. That's still a multi-billion-dollar industry. And a huge relief on the strain that raising so many billions of animals for food is causing. So whether this is a product that is going to be consumed by a fifth of the population or maybe three quarters of the population, I think that's still really TBD. But overall, the biggest barriers are really going to be trying to get costs down and to overcome potential government hurdles. The government ought to be helping to facilitate this type of innovation rather than stifling it.
So one of the things you talk about in the book, Paul, is the leather, the tanning industry and leather, and how this also shows promise in a different way, but for that industry. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's very possible, Lynn. You're right. It's very possible that we are going to be wearing grown leather before we are eating grown meat. So, for example, there's a startup called Modern Meadow that is growing real leather without cows, without any cows at all. And they're already displaying their new creations. I mean, they're making leather shirts and leather jackets and everything out of this. It's really, really incredible. And it could be a gateway. You could imagine that people would feel more comfortable, for example, wearing clean leather before eating clean meat. And once you get accustomed to the idea of real animal products that are void of actual animals, then I think it's not so much of a step to then go to the idea of eating animal products that were void of animals. And I will say one cool thing, that the book Clean Meat, when it was published this year, the very first copy of it was bound in lab-grown leather. And so it is the first book ever in human history to ever be bound in lab-grown leather. And we auctioned it off as a historic artifact. We auctioned it off on eBay, and it sold for about $13,000, all proceeds going to the charity called the Good Food Institute, which promotes this type of work. And you can go, if you go to cleanmeat.com, you can see more of the news stories and photos of that bound, of that lab-grown leather-bound book.
That's great. Oh, I feel a little ripped off. My copy certainly is not leather-bound. Or fake leather bound or whatever.
Yes, it was about 1,000 times more affordable though.
Yeah, exactly. So a quick question before we let you go. I know that you've been vegetarian and or vegan for many decades, a couple decades anyway. And but yet I know that you're open to this, right? And I just wanted to get your take on sort of who's open to it and who's not. And you do mention Michael Pollan in there, who's the author, of course, of The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food. And I thought it was interesting, his take on it. So,
yeah, Michael Pollan essentially told me and is quoted in the book as saying that the problem is so severe that meat consumption is such a burden on the planet, and with especially when you consider how we produce meat and how many people are eating meat, that any alternative is worth exploring. So he doesn't give a full-throated endorsement of clean meat, but he does say it's worth exploring. My own view is the following. Clean meat is real meat. It isn't intended for vegetarians or for vegans. In fact, many polls show that those are the people who are the least likely to want to eat it. The people who are most likely to want to eat it are people who are eating the most amount of meat today, people who are going to fast food restaurants, big box grocery stores, and are eating meat, because this is a way to get meat that is safer, more sustainable, and possibly even healthier. I mean, you could imagine creating meat that's exactly the same as meat today, but you could also imagine creating meat that maybe has less saturated fat and more omega-3 fatty acids. And so you could theoretically imagine a hamburger that, rather than causing heart attacks, actually prevents them. So, no, this isn't a vegetarian food, but if you are a vegetarian and the reason for being a vegetarian is solely because of a concern for the welfare of animals, I do think that that concern is obviated here. I don't really think there's a big concern about that. So people have lots of reasons for being a vegetarian, from health to spirituality and other reasons. But if your only reason for it is animal welfare, yeah, I think that this would probably be a fine food to eat. But of course, vegetarians are a very small portion of the population anyway. And the goal for the makers of clean meat is to sell to meat eaters, not to vegetarians.
Unfortunately, I think we're pretty much out of time, but I just wanted to mention one final thing, and that's that when you do a biopsy of a sesame-size muscle extraction from, say, a turkey, that also contains 12 million satellite cells that goes with that biopsy. There's a lot of things that we need to do as scientists to be able to scale the systems, have the right medium, have the right nutrients, all those different things. But a single cell, because we love math on this program, of turkey can undergo 75 generations of division during 3 months. And if you do the math with 12 million cells, you say in your book, that means that a cell could turn into enough muscle to manufacture over 20 trillion turkey nuggets. So Mother Nature has the ability to be able to scale. We just need to figure it out. Is that correct?
That is so correct, John, and I'm so glad you brought that up. There is a puzzle to be solved here, and if we can solve it, then we are going to do more to address food security and food sustainability issues than perhaps anything that's ever happened before. And as we approach 2050, where we have 7.5 billion of us now, by then we'll probably have around 10 billion of us, the Earth isn't getting any bigger. But humanity's footprint on it is getting bigger, and we have to find ways that will become a lot more efficient about how to feed ourselves And cellular agriculture is one promising solution. And that's why I was so glad to write about it in this book, Clean Meat.
Clean Meat, How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World. Our guest is Paul Shapiro. And, you know, you can either buy his book, or if you're interested in learning a little bit more about it, you're pretty much all over TEDx. You've done quite a few TEDx presentations, so you can just Google Paul Shapiro and TEDx. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, John.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, Paul.